By the way, I do like these movies. I mean, you're looking at the Bourne movies, you're looking at Taken and its sequel, Tooken.
In a world where you only have trailers and posters to judge a movie, Jim and Ted strike out to answer the age-old question, will you see it?
Hi, Jimmy.
Hey, Ted. 420, man. Smoke up. Tell me something good. Tell me something bad. The good, the bad, and the ugly, maybe.
Well, I'll tell you the good. This week, Anne was driving around Burbank with the kids waiting for me to pick me up because we were carpooling a little, you know, most of the days we carpool. And they found a sale at a store called It's a Wrap. Have you heard of this store?
I don't know. I've heard of It's a Wrap. I don't know why I know of it.
Well, they take all the wardrobe from all of the productions in and around LA, and they buy it all from the production companies.
Yes, that's why I know of it. And I don't know why I know that, but I do know that.
Probably because your uncles and, you know, your family in the business.
Yeah, I do have family in the film industry. Maybe they've talked about it in the past.
So they're having an Earth Month sale, and Anne and the kids found a ton of clothes for me. So we went one day, they picked a bunch of stuff, and I went in and, you know, I lost a lot of weight recently. So recently, a year ago. And being a 42 regular, like a normal sized person, is amazing.
Yeah.
Because you walk into a store like that and there is 42 regular all over the store. And you go in, and I basically camped out in a dressing room. And I was just trying stuff on and then throwing it back over and like put it on because it's from sets and it's from wardrobe selections.
Yeah, yeah.
Sometimes it'll say 42 regular, but then they've, you know, the seamstress on set has tailored it to this actor, made it smaller here, bigger there, you know, let it out there. And we got a lot of clothes. Like I got a pair of Brooks Brother pants that fit me, no hem, no nothing. And it was $6. Might have been $5. $5 for a pair of Brooks Brothers pants, the best pants I've ever owned.
Wow, I'm going to have to take a stop there next time we're down in LA.
So that was my amazing find this week. The kids and the wife were running around the store, throwing clothes over the wall and trying to have me try on 100 items in an hour.
Kind of like, what was the scene in The Dictator? Is that what you were doing?
Yeah, like that.
If I knew the episode, I'd tell you, but I don't know. But just go back through our catalog and there's Ted in The Dictator.
The montage of me trying on all this stuff is amazing.
Yeah, awesome.
How about you? What's good this week for you?
So what's good this week for me? You caught me on the spot. Well, okay, if I had to say something. So I'm continuing to work on getting my photography business off the ground.
Oh, cool.
So this week I wound up getting tax ID and EIN, and I'm now official, and I am also geared up to put myself into a silent auction here in town, and it's for a fundraiser for the YMCA STEAM program, and you know, just doing a portrait shoot. I've been like putting the pedal to the metal with photography the past couple weeks.
Nice.
Yeah, yeah. All right, Ted, what do we have tonight?
All right, so this week we have Equalizer 2, an amazing Denzel Washington action movie from Antoine Fuqua, and we have Westworld Season 2, that trailer, and then a little different, but I also wanted to talk about the full first season of Lost in Space because I actually binged it this week. And not a full on binge. It's, you know, Ted's modified binge where I fall asleep a lot and then I rewatch a lot. Unlike Stranger Things, which I gave up on twice now, I persevered.
We watched the first episode.
Of which?
Stranger Things.
Oh, yeah.
Haven't gotten past it.
Yeah, I watched 4 episodes, and that 4th episode, I think I watched 3 times trying to stay awake through it.
And that's season 2, right?
Yeah, it's not the show. It's totally me.
Yeah.
You know? So.
Oh, yeah. You know, and the one thing before we get into what we're talking about, the one thing I want to say about Stranger Things season 2, I mean, we've already seen season 1, but that first episode, you're waiting for the shoe to drop constantly, and it never does. They give you these little teases, and then like...
Yeah.
And then a 3-year-old and a 5-year-old keep getting in the way, and we haven't gotten past it, so... But yeah, Lost in Space, I'm looking forward to talking about that because we finally got to the end of what's current with The Expanse. And I see a lot of parallels, even though I haven't seen Lost in Space yet. So we want to watch it this weekend.
Yeah.
So you want to jump into Equalizer?
Yeah. First up, we'll do the Equalizer 2.
All right. Equalizer 2. I didn't know there was an Equalizer 1.
Yes. So I knew there was Equalizer. I knew that Denzel did Equalizer, but I don't even remember seeing it. So I'm a huge Anton Fuqua fan, but I'm sure people that would hear that I didn't see Equalizer would say that I'm not.
Right.
But I, you know, loved Training Day.
Oh, Training Day was incredible.
Yeah. Replacement Killers was also phenomenal. And that's an even older movie.
Yeah.
But Anton Fuqua is just an amazing in-your-face filmmaker. So I think he has an auteur style. I read a great article about auteur filmmaking and, you know, just re-racking and redefining what auteur filmmaking is and how when you are the auteur, you're the author, you're the main sole creative inspiration for a piece of art that is film. So, you know, a lot of films are collaborative and, you know, show the skills and the talents of a lot of different people on the set because it takes so many people to make a movie. But the auteur theory says that the director is the main artist and it is his vision that is put up on the screen. And I liked rereading that definition because, you know, I think sometimes we overuse it.
Yeah.
But I think this is one guy who really falls into that space for action, which is kind of a unique thing. And it was interesting. I heard an interview of his and he actually found inspiration in classic Renaissance painter. He loved Caravaggio. And when I heard that, it was so exciting to me because Caravaggio is my favorite of the Renaissance or of that time period. Anne will probably slay me if I get that wrong. But
well, she is the art historian.
Yeah, but Caravaggio was at the Getty, and they had a traveling Caravaggio exposition, and I went with my son Bryce, and we were seeing, he wanted to see the City of Gold, so we went for that.
Yeah.
And then Caravaggio was on like one of the wings, and I went into this room full of Caravaggio paintings, and I was like, oh, I've seen these all, and I saw them all in different places. So I've seen them in Italy with my wife when we were on our honeymoon, and then we saw them again when they were traveling in when we were in Prague, and then this was the third time I was seeing them, and it was just his just dark subject matter. And you know, Anton Fuqua was taken aback by how violent and how he wasn't, you know, when you think of the Renaissance and you think of those people, I guess you kind of put them on a pedestal, and he thought it was really neat how scrappy Caravaggio was and how from the streets he was, and he was kind of like a very streetwise hothead. So I like that idea, and I think it comes through that is something that would get to the director of a movie like this.
You know, I was looking at some of the Caravaggio pictures while you were talking, and some of them, like you said, they are dark. And as looking at them, I do recall a number of, because I typed in Caravaggio at the Louvre.
Uh-huh.
And as you're looking at them, I do recall a number of them when we were at the Louvre. So he does have some fascinating images, to be sure, like David and Goliath, where David's holding the head of Goliath. I mean, like, talk about morbid, but brilliant.
Yeah. I mean, I think my favorite is the Judith beheading, because he tried to put elements of himself in a lot of his paintings.
Uh-huh.
So like some of the features on the severed head, both in David and Goliath, and the feature of whoever Holofernes or whatever is this guy's name is, who's getting his head cut off. Whoever's getting his head cut off, he usually does a little bit of a self-portraiture into that person.
Yeah, oh, they're brilliant.
But anyway, so that's a little departure. I thought it was interesting that someone as rooted in violent action cinema is still motivated by, you know, Italian Renaissance.
And it's funny you mentioned Training Day. When I was leaving the Army, I applied and got accepted with LAPD.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And so... Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. So I went and, you know, you do the psych eval and you do all the, what do they call that thing where they put it around your chest, you know? The
lie detector?
The lie detector, but whatever the name is. Uh-huh. But anyway, you know, they do all this stuff, right? And the one reason, the number one reason why I turned down the LAPD and I went into psychology and got my, you know, went to graduate school to be a school psychologist and all this stuff. So I was at where they do the interviews and everything downtown LA. So you're sitting there and there's like these three dorky dudes, you know, I'm one of the three. And this beautiful girl walks in, right? And she's gonna, uh-huh. she's there to quote unquote apply for the police position too. And so she's chatting up everybody, right? And
yeah,
and you know, I had secret clearance in the Army and all this stuff. And when someone starts asking like weird questions, it makes you think like, why are they asking this stuff? Like, and when's the last time like this, like some hot woman starts chatting me up out of nowhere? Well, the other two guys are just like, they're just, this is blah, 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 blah. I did this and they're just spilling their guts. And I was really reserved. So we go in, I do the interview. Well, no, this is even way after the interview. This is like the final thing right before you get like your slot for the academy.
Uh-huh.
So I go in and I do the lie detector test. Man, what's the name of it? It's driving me crazy. But I do the lie detector test. So the detective, he said, yeah, I noticed you were very reserved out there and you didn't give much information to, you know, I don't know her name, but I'll just say Detective Smith. Well, I was like, yeah, but Detective Smith was probably somebody on the inside.
Yeah.
And he was like, well, what makes you say that? Whatever. I'm like, because when's the last time some good looking woman came just like chatting me up, like out of nowhere and all this stuff? I'm like, it was just too suspicious to me, you know, and all this. So anyway, I go through the whole thing and
you're like straight to detective school for you.
Right. And the whole time I was thinking of Training Day. Right. Because
yeah,
I'm just like, and I'm just thinking to myself, that's going to be me. I'm going to be sitting there and my entire career is going to be scrutinized by my partner, you know, and internal affairs is going to be doing what they do and stuff. And then finally, I was just like, you know what? I can't do it. I just can't do it because Training Day was just chewing at the back of my head. And the whole time I just kept thinking about how I'll never be able to relax at work because I would be so afraid that you just say the slightest of the wrong thing. And next thing you know, your job's on the chopping block and you're smeared across the news. And then you're thinking about Rodney King and all this stuff. And I'm just like, it ain't worth it. I'm just going to do something else, you know? So anyway. Lo and behold.
Oh, it's called a polygraph.
A polygraph. There you go. Yeah. You go. Thank you. But yeah, lo and behold, like, I work in education and I'm probably better off for it.
Definitely.
I get more time to travel, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So what's your initial thoughts?
My initial thoughts for Equalizer 2 is it's a gritty, old school action shoot 'em up kind of movie. So
yeah.
You know, Denzel's your typical badass, take no prisoners kind of assassin, showing his skills at every turn. You know, like, I love it. Opens up in Turkey and Istanbul, and the Blue Mosque is there. Nice establishing shot. It actually motivates the setting, not like last week when we were talking about the Meg and it didn't matter where they were in the ocean. You know what I mean? But when he's talking about these Turkish gangsters that kidnapped an American child, it made sense. You know, they're on a train, he's like wiping people out, and he has the wherewithal to set his stopwatch to see how fast he can kill all these people on the train to save this little girl, and he's like 10.9 seconds, I still got it. You know what I mean?
Did you do what I did?
Did you time it?
I looked at the time on his watch and how long it took in the trailer, and they matched perfect.
Yeah, they matched exactly.
Yeah. So in the trailer, his watch was, like you said, 10.9 seconds. And as the trailer goes on, you know, when he starts, like I kind of started. And as it goes through, it ends at that same time. And when you look at the trailer time, it's like everything lined up like identical. It was brilliant.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Would you say it's not a very complex story? I mean, it seems like some...
Oh, they lay it all out in this trailer, right? We know exactly what's going on.
There's a group that killed his friend. It does show, like, he's like, okay, let me back up a little bit. So he comes off as this hardcore killer. There's no remorse. And he is just out for vengeance. And he's the most badass dude on the planet. Which, by the way, I do like these movies. I mean, you're looking at the Bourne movies. You're looking at Taken and its sequel, Tooken. And 24, you know, the 24 series with Jack Bauer and all this stuff. And all these things. I love these this genre of movie.
Yeah.
However, it is a simple story, I think, in that there's a group that's kind of like Taken, right?
I don't know who you are. I don't know what you want. If you are looking for a ransom, I can tell you I don't have money. But what I do have are a very particular set of skills. Skills I have acquired over a very long career. Skills that make me a nightmare for people like you. If you let my daughter go now, that'll be the end of it. I will not look for you. I will not pursue you. But if you don't, I will look for you. I will find you. And I will kill you.
There's a group that has killed his friend, and he is out for blood against every member of that group. And he's not going to stop until they're all dead. And he just goes out, kills everybody, and then the story's over. I mean, it's not a very complex story, unfortunately.
No. And I think, these films are not about the complexity of that, of plot, of exposition. You know, it's meant to, you know, all the exposition that we need is in this trailer.
Yeah.
It's just filling in the blanks. You aren't even, like, concerned about Denzel. You aren't even concerned about him as a person, because there is no scenario where the Equalizer will not make it out at the end.
Right.
It's not even a thought that ever crosses your mind. He'll get shot. He'll get nicked here and there. You know what I mean? He'll take some bumps. He'll look like he's losing a fight.
King Kong ain't got shit on me.
No, it'll be suspenseful.
I think maybe some stuff will be suspenseful.
You don't think so?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I like it a lot. I like it just for how cool it's going to be, not for the suspense.
And you're right about that. I mean, I think the reason why dudes like these kind of movies is because, like, okay, it's suspense, it's espionage, it's the fight choreography. And the fight choreography is kind of set up in the sense to say that, like, no one could really ever do it the way they do in the movies and everything. And of course, like, the first time I've ever seen or was ever in a Foley room and learning about sound and looking at all the stuff in how they do effects, I remember there was a sound engineer and he said, well, the whole point of movies is to be bigger than life. Mm-hmm. So somebody's walking down a gravel road, you have to crunch gravel to make it sound like they're walking down a gravel road, because they're not picking that up in the shot, so they have to make it bigger than life. And so everything you're hearing,
right,
is, you know, everything you're hearing is, like, just bigger than life, essentially. It's manufactured.
Yeah, it's all manufactured. It's all pieced together perfectly by experts at their part of the craft that is filmmaking.
Right. So when you look at movies like this and the choreography of, you know, as a for instance, when Denzel is getting attacked in the car while he's driving and he totally, like, kicks the guy's ass who's in the back seat, who clearly has the advantage, right? I mean, that guy surprises him, comes across with, like, a Rambo knife. The Rambo knife fails. He pulls out, like, a 9mm, and he's still neutralized to the point where Denzel takes the 9mm and then caps him. And then, like, the whole, like, it's incredible, right? Like, who does that? Nobody does that.
Even the hug to his dead partner's son is a violent interaction. Like, he grabs him with a ferocity that
the point is, talking about how Denzel does these superhuman feats of strength as far as the fights and all these, and tying it in with what I meant with the Foley and all that stuff, is that the reason dudes like these kind of movies is because they want to be the hero in their life, you know? So you're sitting at the restaurant and you say, oh, no, I got to, you know, how many guys do this? I got to face the door, you know, like something goes down. I got to be ready, right? And it's like, really, dude, something goes down. You're like 50 yards from the door. Like, it doesn't even matter. You're not going to be ready, you know? And like, whatever. But like, guys want to believe that they're going to be the hero in their life to save the day. And I'm not saying people aren't the hero. People can certainly be, but it gets to the point where I think it feeds into like that masculine fantasy that you're the man, and we all just buy into it, you know? I mean, we're all Jason Bourne, you know, we're all Jack Bauer or whatever it is, right? So we buy into that character, and this is just another one of those like hero's journey type movies to where we're gonna be the guy to just take down the bad guys.
Yeah.
And it's over.
I do. You're so right, because you talked about the LAPD, and my cousin is actually DCPD.
Okay.
And he's Bryce's godfather, his Ninong, he calls him. Uncle Wade. And Uncle Wade was playing with Bryce when he was super young, like 2 or 3 years old. And he's at the house and Bryce is climbing all over him. And he's sliding down Uncle Wade's like side, and Bryce gets hung up like on his belt, right?
Uh-huh.
And he can't slide down his belt. And Anne's like, what's Bryce stuck on?
You know? What, his pistol or something?
And he's stuck on his 9mm on his side. He's in plain clothes. He doesn't have any, you know, he's off duty, but he's still got his 9mm on his side.
Yeah.
And we're like, and Anne freaked out. She was like, oh my God, you have a gun. And Bryce just kicked it with his foot, and he's like 2 years old. And he goes, well, what do you want to do? Leave the gun in the car? I can't leave the gun in the car.
Right.
And we're laughing with my other cousin. And she was like, yeah, Wade tells me, like, if something does go down, that wherever he tells me to go run, I have to go run there and not to look back.
Yeah.
So he actually says that he doesn't like these kind of movies because he's like, I don't need to see it. I live it.
Right.
So he gets his adrenaline on the streets, and you and I like to watch it in the comfort of our home and theater.
Well, and the funny thing about it, though, is like Denzel is like so badass in this movie.
Yeah.
And again, like I said, I mean, so is Jason Bourne and all these, you know.
And John Wick.
Yeah. You know? All these movies, right? Like, the main character is just such a badass. And the funny thing is, like I said, like, it's the hero in all of us. But the funny part about it, though, is like how like few of us have the stomach for it. You know, right. What I mean? Like if it really went down, I mean, I don't know what you would do. I mean, I don't know, but like, I couldn't be a CIA assassin or like high paid. What does he tell the guy who laughs at the end? Like,
oh yeah,
he's like, oh, don't tell me. Like, he gives a shh, but I'm a government assassin, high paid government whatever he says.
I'm a high level paid government assassin.
Yeah.
And then the guy looks at him like, are you serious? And he just laughs. Like, how awesome would it be to tell somebody that? And like, you're being dead serious, and you know that like nobody on earth is going to believe you. So you can tell the truth and feel comfortable in your skin to say, oh, that's what I do.
Yeah.
I mean, the movie looks super violent.
Super violent. Super cool. Denzel was John Wick before John Wick.
Yeah. And it's a different violence too. I mean, when you think of something like, you know, we've talked in the past about Hostel and things like that's like screw with your head violence, where this is more just like gratuitous violence.
Yeah, this is straight up violence that you could almost, you know, explain away.
Yeah,
it's like you don't have to. It's so over the top that it lacks any kind of grounding to something that you could see.
Yeah, and with that, it goes back to kind of how the TV show 24 was. So the bad guys were like super simple. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, of course, any bad guy has to have that like generic Eastern European accent, you know, like they would always do, right? And they would always have like, it's the generic Eastern European accent with the detonator to the nuclear bomb that's planted in the White House garden under the roses. And it's just, when is the hero going to track him down?
Right.
And that's the whole story. Like, oh my God, how is, like, what is he going to go through until he actually finds it and then like neutralizes it? And that's kind of how these are, you know, just like you said, is that the violence is there just for, I don't know, it's just part of the story to...
It's a layer, yeah.
It's a layer. It moves the story along. And the bad guys are not very complex. It's not like there's like a philosophical dilemma or an ethical dilemma that they're trying to navigate. It's just you have, here's the good guy. No matter what bad he does, we know he's the good guy. And here's the bad guy. And no matter what good he does, he is identified as the bad guy, and you just follow that path, and then the movie ends.
Yeah. I just love the idea of two of these Academy Award winning actors playing, you know, in this movie that is just like this fun violence, you know?
One thing I do like, though, is so Denzel's kind of this cold-blooded killer. But the one thing about it, they do try to interject and show his... what would you call, like, his emotional, like, he's not an emotionless robot killer. I mean, he does have a human side to him, you know, when he's, like you said, he's hugging his partner's son.
Yeah, and all the pieces, you know, the laughing and the, like you said, when he told his neighbor about, you know, how he's the assassin, secret assassin for the CIA.
Yeah, he has a job to do, you know, he's tasked with a job, and he's going to discharge his job to the fullest extent of his ability, take out the bad guys, and you're going to cheer him on while he does it, and justice is served and it's over.
Yep.
You know, it's one of those, like, I mean, there's, as I said, entertainment, definitely. Complex story, not really.
No.
So do you have a 3-word review, or do you have anything else you want to add? I think we might have covered it okay.
No, I definitely think we covered it, and I would go back to Caravaggio's Kindred Spirit.
Caravaggio's Kindred Spirit. So Caravaggio's so going back to the auteur.
Yes, going back to Anton Fuqua.
Anton Fuqua. And then the kindred spirit in of the...
Of just the... Of him, of Caravaggio as an artist and Fuqua as an artist.
Cool. I like that. Actually, that's probably one of your more nuanced ones that are actually kind of cool. Made me think for a second there. I like it, though. I like it. Yeah, overall, I mean, I Denzel's one of my favorite actors. I mean, I think the guy, like, let's put it this way. Every movie I've seen him in has been just a phenomenal movie that I've seen him in. Like, I don't think I've ever seen a performance of his that hasn't been good.
Yeah.
So yeah, that alone, I mean, he's gonna make the movie. I mean, there's no doubt about it.
It was amazing. Like the first Christmas that I was here, I think it was maybe, I guess wasn't the first, it was the second Christmas. In 2005, we went to the Four Seasons for a Christmas party for the office where I was working. And part of our Christmas party favors or the gift was a brunch pass for, you know, you and a guest, you know. So Ann and I went to brunch at the Four Seasons down in Beverly Hills. And we went on the Sunday morning of the Oscars.
Okay.
And when we went there, we went to this brunch, which is like a typical brunch, except there was Denzel Washington, Bernie Mac, I think it was Beyonce and Jay-Z was there. Was it the Oscars or was it the Grammys? I don't know. I think it might have been the Grammys.
You could tell me whatever it is and I'll believe you.
But whatever it was an amazing, star-studded event. And I think it was the Grammys, but Denzel goes there all the time. So it was amazing to see so many stars in one place. Larry Flint was there. I was like, oh my God.
Nice. Well, one last thing that I wanted to talk about, and this kind of can fit into a lot of different movies. In The Equalizer 2, so there's a scene where it looks like it's Denzel Washington, but he hits the Lyft app, and because they're going to drive somewhere, and it's like, oh, well, I got to go pick up the guy or whatever, and he hits the app, and then, like, it moves on, and it says Lyft, you know, L-Y-F-T, just, you know, the way it is.
Yeah.
As a product placement, so I would assume there's probably some sort of a product placement that money was exchanged to get that into that scene.
You think so?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, exchanged one way or the other. I don't know which,
right.
But you know, in other words, Lyft wants to get in, or maybe a mutual agreement, but Lyft wants to get their edge against Uber and all this stuff. So they're in there, or the movie wants to have Lyft to seem more relevant and more
authentic.
Right. Which kind of brings me to the part of, I mean, the authenticity is important, but I think things like that and those types of product placements dates movies. Because either the app's going to change, the phones are going to change, the screens change and things, you know, color schemes and all that change, or the company just outright goes out of business.
Right.
And then 10 years from now, you're watching the movie and you're like, you know, it's like watching Wall Street and they have like, you know,
the brick phones.
The brick next to their head talking on the phone.
Greed, for lack of a better word, is good.
And it's just dates. I mean, don't get me wrong. It's kind of the brilliance of the movie that in spite of the old computers and the old phones and stuff, the movie still holds up.
Yeah.
But it does date it, though, and tells of the time that it was filmed. I don't know. Just what are your thoughts about product placements and just the way they put them into movies?
Yeah. I mean, I think when you have movies like this, I think these movies are made to be part of the tableau of pop culture. And it's okay. You know, the action in this movie can kind of, like you said, rise above that. And then it's meant to be put out in this time frame. And I don't know whether Anton Fuqua is thinking about how this movie would play 10 years from now.
So you're saying it might not have staying power?
Yeah, I don't think it necessarily has to. I think it's more important to show. I took that very specific interaction as a shorthand to say that, you know, he kills people by night. And then after he patches things up and gives the daughter back to the mother, you know, he goes and he's a Lyft driver just because he can do that kind of anonymously. Because he had just finished telling Melissa Leo they joked about him being dead.
Yeah.
So he could be anonymous and he could be a Lyft driver and it's okay.
Hilarious. I didn't even think of he's killer by night, Lyft driver by day. I mean, all right. Coming up on Trailer Junkies Podcast.
I think there's a kindred nature between Reed Hastings and Bob Iger. I think there's a possible bromance if they could ever get together. Kind of like a Mortimer, a Duke brother, a Duke brother kind of trading places kind of thing they could get going.
If you enjoy our trailer reviews, or even if you hate them, let us know. We love feedback. We're on Twitter at T Junkies Podcast and Instagram at Trailer Junkies Podcast. You can also comment on the episodes at trailerjunkiespodcast.com. Our email is info@trailerjunkiespodcast.com. And you could also leave us a review in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Now let's get back to it. So Westworld. So that premiered last Sunday, April 22nd.
That's right. So are you excited to watch it? Did you see all the first season?
Yeah. No, I'm very excited to watch it. Did you see the first season?
I'm 4 episodes into the first season.
Okay. Oh man, I won't give you any spoilers then. It gets there are things in this trailer that if you finished the first season, you would look at the trailer and say, well, how is this going on and why is this guy now behaving the way he's behaving? And
well, I don't, so I'm not concerned about spoilers. I don't, you know.
Well, I'm not going to tell you because they're pretty significant spoilers.
Okay. You know, I enjoy the filmmakers and the storytellers of this world.
Uh-huh.
I'm super excited to get back into it. It's been really hard watching the Lost in Space over the past 2 weeks. So I've had to really put a lot of effort into it. So Westworld, what's your overall take on it?
Well, let me first ask, did you see the 1973 movie with Yul Brynner?
I did not see that.
Okay. You know, I saw it probably, I mean, man, at this point, probably in the 80s. It was, like I said, it came out in 73, which, I did a little bit of research and I was surprised. I didn't know it was written and directed by Michael Crichton.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's cool. So I watched about a 10-minute clip, highlights of that movie, and it's very similar to the first season of Westworld. But I think what what my first take on it is, looking at the robots and the humans and knowing who is robot and who is human and how the robots are, they've it's almost as if they've taken on a personal conscious state.
Yes.
And to include the robots that run the program, because there's robots that run the program.
Yeah.
That you don't realize run the program, not to spoil anything, but the thing I think I find most fascinating is that the robots can't kill, right? Or they can't harm you. And that's how the original movie was too. The robots can't harm you, but then there's a turn in there where then they can harm you.
Right.
But the one part that I don't really understand, and to include the original movie and to include with what they're doing, is where do they get the weaponry that can harm you? Because their weapons, their pistols and shotguns and et cetera, they're designed to not hurt people. But yet they wind up getting weapons and so on that can harm. They find their way into the main headquarters. They start taking over the main headquarters. And then it looks like in this one, they wind up like in the regular society somehow out on the streets.
No, it definitely feels like a coup. There was some other pieces, another trailer that was a bit of a teaser trailer for season two, where it had like the running of the bulls, but they're mechanical bulls running through the hallways and what do you call that place?
Like their headquarters?
Yeah, the headquarters. I really appreciate the idea of how next level they take the idea of what is eventually going to happen conceptually to us and our interaction with computers, you know? It just jumps ahead. Does it even say what time in the real world it is?
2052.
Okay. Yeah. So the jump's 50 years ahead. Maybe with the acceleration that we're on, it could happen, but it feels like it's much further ahead than that. But I think it's an interesting idea to think that these machines are so advanced that a virus, like a computer virus, all it has to be is a whispered utterance. All it has to be is a simple idea placed in one of these machines, robots, and then shared amongst them and socialized amongst all these same similar robots. Because the robots are so advanced that you could say the same thing about words and ideas that humans share.
Well, emotion.
Yeah, all of that. So I too don't understand that because I haven't seen all of this, but all of the first season. But I love the ideas and the places that Nolan and his wife are taking us through this whole thing.
And it goes back to what I've said about these about futuristic movies. I mean, you're looking at 35 years in the future. In 35 years, are we going to have robots? I mean, I know Disney has like the animatronics, right? And I don't know if you've seen in the first season yet where he goes down to like the cellar where they have like the cold storage of robots.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And there's the guy that he has a drink with every so often and hangs out with. And it's like the first character that they've developed, right? And he has the very animatronic type movements, you know, and he's very like robotic-like and very stiff and jerky in his motion and all that stuff, right? Kind of Disney-esque in a way, as you see like with Abe Lincoln, Abe Lincoln thing and all this. It's one of those things where these movies are never in the future enough, because in 35 years, we're going to be bullet training to a Westworld or a Shogun world that they're going to weave in, or they're going to do any of this kind of stuff. And it's going to be where you can't tell the difference. Like, I don't think so.
Well, I mean, look at the Yul Brynner one, though.
Well, that's what I was going to say, the Yul Brynner one. So that was filmed in 1973, and it took place in 1983, right? Just 10 years. I mean, why not go out like 500 years from now or something? So no one alive will ever know, and anyone who is alive then and watches some 500-year-old movie, all they're going to do is look back and go, yeah, they missed it by 100 years, but they got it pretty close. Like, it happened in 2400, you know, but they were pretty much spot on, you know? I mean, like, it's just these movies are too near in the future to actually be believable.
I don't know. I think we're advancing at such a rate that we're taking off.
So is that the argument? The advancement of technology is going so fast, we're just going to get there anyway?
Yeah, we're on the upswing of an exponential curve of technology.
So it's like the hockey stick curve.
Yeah.
Well, maybe you're right. I don't know. The other thing that watching this that kind of bothers me a little bit, and you see it in the trailer, the robots are, well, extremely human. They are human because they're actors, but they're very human-like, right?
Yes.
But when they show somebody with their face cut off or, you know, an arm cut off or something, then they look really plasticky.
Yeah.
So why is it that the character, the actress, actor, whichever it is, I mean, they look superhuman because they are human.
Mm-hmm.
But once someone kills them, all of a sudden they look like a plastic lump of robot. Why don't they continue to look just like human, but like dead human?
I don't know. I guess it's got to be a choice. Maybe it's part of that uncanny valley. I think the uncanny valley is your human lizard brain recognizing that it's something that's not exactly what it's supposed to be. So maybe that's part of why they do that. But I don't know why they would. They should just like step it up regardless of what state of,
yeah,
you know, human they are. I agree.
And it's cool, too, because I think it, as you watch it, it calls into question, like, what does it mean to be human?
Yeah, totally.
You know, it's like if a robot can be human or at least believe that itself is human and go through the steps of its day in a human, I don't know, in a human way of doing things, it almost says that you as a human is less significant because you could be replaced by a robot who does the exact same things and can fool people into having the exact same emotions to the point you can't tell the difference.
I mean, I appreciate that sentiment. So it's a cool theory.
Yeah.
And a cool place to bring it too. It's like there's constant nostalgia for the Wild West. So to bring the future into the Wild West, it's a neat play on both being set in the future, but in a fantasy world that is set in the past.
Right. Yeah. And the music.
So this is my favorite thing about the whole trailer.
The music.
The music.
Oh, the music's fantastic. And it plays off of the intro of the first season when they have like the robot, whatever, playing the piano.
Oh, it does?
I think so. You know, and it's like, I mean, because that's the whole point of the original or the first season is the robots like playing the piano in that. I mean, I don't know what the song is, but it's just a brilliant piano piece.
Okay. So I do know what the song was. And the minute that we put this together, I immediately said Heart-Shaped Box because this is Nirvana's song off of the second.
Is that what it is?
Yeah, it's off their second album. Yeah, and then after digging around a little bit because I'm like, oh, it's so haunting, you know? It's not your typical rehashing of the song. The people who scored and wrote the music for Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
They also compose this arrangement of Heart-Shaped Box.
So is that the same for the first season intro music?
It might be.
Okay, but you're saying that then Nirvana is for the second season trailer music.
Yes, so the second season, this trailer that's in this podcast has an arrangement of Heart-Shaped Box over the whole trailer.
Okay, now I got to listen again when we're done here. So yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
At Heart-Shaped Box, it was such a great song to me when I was growing up, and it was such a cool way to talk about, you know, kind of tabooed things, and it really plays on the idea of what drives most of the stuff in Westworld, which is the sex.
And that kind of brings me to Dolores at the end of the trailer when she says, you know, when I can't remember his name, but the black guy says to Dolores, like, you know, you frighten me. And then she says, you know, quotes like,
why on earth would you ever be frightened of me?
It kind of leads me to think that she might become the de facto leader of the robot rebellion. She's the reason why they all rise up to begin with.
Yes.
Because that's in a way the first season brought you there.
Yeah.
Because she was kind of like the portal of infection to, as you mentioned, like a virus to bring in to say it's time for the robots to become self-aware. So, and she's all of a sudden become self-aware. So, and that's why he's afraid of her. You know, it's intense.
It's amazing. And her facial expressions through that whole scene, you know, they just let it play out. You don't have to cut away. You know, there's no, it lets it sit on all these certain, you know, all these spaces and the faces. And it just plays out in that super close, that close up. That's just haunting.
And then it looks like they're going to be weaving in like Shogun World or something into the story and getting some other things going with that.
Yeah, Thandie Newton, I think, is walking around a Shogun world, which looked amazing. So amazing sets, amazing set pieces, amazing design.
Oh, HBO does it right. I mean, they don't mess around.
They spend some money.
And it's funny, too, because if you think about HBO, I mean, kind of the running gag is that everybody's stealing their content and no one's paying for it. But clearly a lot of people are paying for it, for them to have the money to put into these shows and to create the content that they create.
Yes. No, it's amazing. And to kind of to sustain a high bar for, you know, a majority of the stuff that you put out, majority of the content that you put out is kind of amazing. You know, like they don't have the quantity of a Netflix, and they don't have like the, they don't have to be a broad appeal media source. You know, they can have a bit of a niche market as long as they stay ultra high quality, high end, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, and Netflix is like what, $10, $11 a month or something for streaming. And I think that's what HBO is. It's like $10 a month or something, isn't it?
I thought it was like 10, it was either 10 or 15. We get it as part of a package, so we don't even know what it is a la carte.
Yeah, so like a la carte, you know, getting it through the Roku box and all that stuff. But the thing about it, though, is when you look at what you're paying and the amount of content, like right now we're watching Silicon Valley, and when you watch all these shows and what you're getting and the quality of the content, and of course Game of Thrones, which I was shocked Anne doesn't watch. Oh man, we got to do that trailer when it comes out. I can't wait, and I'm sure a lot of people can't wait. But no, I mean, but the point I'm getting at is HBO, for what you're paying for, like you mentioned, you get a ton of quality content, where for that same price in Netflix, you do get a lot of the great content, but there's also a lot of junk that's in there too that you could probably wait, you know, you probably don't necessarily need to wade through to get to the things that you want to see. And I mean, they do have their filter that brings what you want to see to the surface that probably HBO doesn't necessarily have, but they don't need to have that filter because
right,
most of what series are good.
But I think if you're talking about hitting, like my kids are older than your kids, so they're watching a little, I don't know, probably watch a little more TV, a little more media than your kids do right now. And I feel like Netflix is definitely angling to get a wider range of audience.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
HBO wants that upper slice. And I just pulled up a price grid here. HBO Now a la carte is $15 a month.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So you get three streams for that. And then Netflix has two price levels at $10 a month and $12 a month. And then Amazon Prime's in there at $100 a year.
I mean, generally speaking, though, when you do look at HBO, you're looking at, as you mentioned, that top tier. And yeah, everything that we watch, I mean, it tends to have adult content, adult language, nudity, you know, it has all that rated R type content,
right,
where Netflix is going to have a wide spectrum of a lot of different things, from children's programming to documentaries and, you know, movies and whatever comes through the stream. Right now, they tend to have a lot of Disney stuff as far as...
Not for long.
Oh, Netflix?
Yeah.
Ooh. Get your Moana while you can is what you're saying.
Exactly. I think 2019, Bob's pulling it all back.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah. Wow. That's good. Good intel. Don't tell anybody. It's between me and you.
It's common knowledge. So, you know, there's no inside there.
So to finalize it, the only robot, you know, I want to have to deal with is my little vacuum cleaner robot. It goes around the house, cleans up my house, you know. So what's your three-word review?
All right. My three-word for you for this is, I already said it, heart-shaped box.
Yeah, heart-shaped box. There you go.
It tickled me and it was amazing. So
cool.
There you go.
All right. So finally, we don't need to go deep into it since it's already been out and you binged it and everything, but Lost in Space. Let's talk a little bit about it.
So for me, Lost in Space, the reason I wanted to talk about it and the reason that I forced myself to binge it, I definitely wanted to watch it, and I want to watch a lot of things. So that wasn't the full criteria of why I wanted to talk about it. Lost in Space is actually what we were hinting about when we were talking about how HBO has developed their audience, and they know their audience, and they are writing to their audience, and they're developing to their audience. I think Netflix with Lost in Space has really shifted to a place where they are going for a much bigger slice. I think this is one of the most ambitious things that I've seen them put together. I think that Bright was before this a big step in that direction of trying to get this big movie audience. And now they're going into a space where they're trying to supersize the availability of a TV show. So when you think about the original Lost in Space way back when, those TV shows were made for families to watch together. And they had something for the kids, and they had something for the adults. And then if you have the third generation, you have grandparents in your house, maybe they have something that spans like three generations of a family, you know, sitting around a television and watching it. I think that this series, these 10 episodes, is doing the same thing for Netflix's audience. You know, the first couple episodes, I actually thought we could share it with the kids, but then it got a little darker. So I think it's hitting that PG-13 range.
Yeah.
And it has a wider cast than you would think for, you know, all the Lost in Spaces before have been the family plus the pilot, you know, Captain West or whatever. And then the foil, the Dr. Smith. But I like the idea that they've now put in a bunch of other families, and there's international spaceships that are from other countries. So they get a little wider audience. And I think they're just pushing the envelope on expanding the audience.
So what did you call that when it's like something like
the four quadrants?
Four quadrants. There you go. Yeah. Like a Cars or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I loved the old TV show when I was a kid, and I was surprised that you saw it. I didn't see it yet, and I plan to watch it this weekend. And that is the robot. It looks like they find him on another planet rather than bringing him with. Is that true?
Yeah. So he's
okay.
He's part of the stuff that goes wrong when they're...
He's the intelligent life they find.
Exactly.
So do you think the trailer did... Now that you watched it and you see the trailer, do you think the trailer did a good job of selling the show?
There's a couple trailers. The big super trailer did a good job of selling the show and what it was going to have in it. You know, as with any science fiction, you have to suspend disbelief about, you know, the viability of everything, you know?
Yeah, of course.
But I enjoyed the way that actually the first teaser trailer, before they had a lot of footage, they just showed like the Robinson family walking, and then they intercut like old like Apollo missions and, you know, old rockets taking off and things like that. And at first I thought that they were just using that to sell the idea of the show because they didn't have any footage. But now that I've watched the first season, it really does harken back to the Apollo missions, and they have a real reverence for the way that Apollo, you know, launched us into space in a way that is unmatched. Because of circumstances beyond their control, they basically have to pare everything down to get back into space off of this planet, you know, that is not working out for them. So when they do that, they use all the current technology, but they kind of have to break it down into its rudimentary parts to launch this smaller craft into space. So
yeah,
it balances expectation against surprises very well. So like, you know, there's a lot of times when you're watching things, your brain is putting stuff together. So there's a certain degree of things that you want, your mind wants to work out. So you want to have your expectations met, and then you also want a degree of surprise. And I think it tries to balance that very well. And then there's a lot of nurturing going on because it's a family. And then in spurts, the mother gets very, very regimented and she becomes, you know, the captain of this process, you know, and she's like, you know, when she's trying to launch her husband into space, they run through these drills. And it's like, when she's doing that, she's doing it because she wants him to be prepared, but she's also doing it in a very rough manner, you know, because space is hard and you're, you know, there's 100 ways to die in space, you know?
Yeah.
So I just love the idea of soft and hard things put together, you know, hopes and dreams and despair all put together. And, you know, it just feels like that Netflix is trying to write out this balance between everything that anyone could want from anything. And I think it's getting a little criticism for that. It's trying, you know, like if you're trying to be everything for everyone, then you're nothing for no one kind of thing.
Right.
But I feel like, you know, if you have buckets and buckets of money like they do, give this a shot and push it out there and see what it does for itself, you know, because you'll get the real numbers of who watches to the end and how are they watching it. And, you know, anytime that you have a family drama, the way this boy and his father interact is amazing. You know, his dad's he's a great dad, but he's just not there for the kids because he's like, he's a military dad. So he re-enlists and he re-ups. And when he re-ups, you know, the wife's had it because he didn't have to re-up.
Right.
And the son, all he wants to do is play, you know, catch. So he teaches the robot to play catch with him. You know, it's like all of these things that are so heartbreaking. And yet it's what holds them together. You know,
it strikes me as a family who's trying to stick together through hard times, as many stories are.
Yeah.
And as they go through their trials and the tough times, you see where they're kind of glued together and then where they where things fall apart. But the trailer itself, it almost struck me as like a movie trailer and not a TV series trailer, because the people who cut the trailer together must have had so much content to deal with.
Yeah.
You know, 10 episodes, so say 10 hours. Where a movie might be, you know, is what, an hour and a half to 2 hours. But they had, say, 10 hours of content that they had to cut down into 2.5 minutes. And it really played out like a movie trailer, because you don't really know what episode each scene was from. And the way they tie it together, and you see kind of the growth of, well, you see the despair when they go crashing and then they meet the robot and then the family's having their problems, but they're sticking together, like you said, and all that. And then, I mean, it totally plays out like a movie trailer and not a TV series trailer.
It is. Yeah. I mean, it's a 10-hour movie. It's a movie that if you could sit down for 10 hours and watch it, you could probably get through the whole thing.
Well, right. But I mean, think about it, though. Like, okay, a 10-hour movie. But how do you choose, out of 10 hours, how do you choose the right scenes to cut together a 2.5-minute trailer? I mean, it's like, to me, that is where the brilliance comes in, because you're looking at like 5 times the content of a typical movie.
Yeah.
So you have to cut out 5 times the content.
Did you ever watch Lost?
You know, I never got into Lost.
You never got into Lost?
I probably watched about 5 episodes and I just couldn't get into it.
Today I was, you know, looking around at all these different trailers, and I found, I think, the best piece of marketing, best piece of long form marketing I've ever seen. It did 5 seasons of Lost. So I think that was like 70 episodes, 70 hours of television in 8 minutes. So it did every point of exposition through 8 minutes through 5 seasons of episodes.
Wow.
And like the way that they did the VO and all the SOTs that they pulled out of the various episodes of 5 seasons was amazing. And then right at the end, it says, get all 5 seasons on Blu-ray and you're get ready for the final season. So it's like, it was the super, super served 8-minute trailer, getting you prepared, telling you everything that's happened up to this point, so that you're ready for the final season of Lost.
All right. So yesterday, you know, we're chit-chatting through Slack and everything like we typically do, and I learned what SOT was yesterday. And you're throwing around SOT, and I'm sure maybe, I mean, there might be some people out there that know, but for our audience, what on earth is SOT?
So SOT stands for sound on tape. And basically, it's just any dialogue or sound that you lift out of a clip.
So when we put in, you're going to need a bigger boat.
Yep.
Like what we did with the Meg, that's an SOT.
That's an SOT.
Okay.
When we did the tacos, SOT. You know, when we did Spinal Tap, all of that stuff, those are SOTs.
And there you have it, folks. Ted, once again, comes through with his lingo and jargon.
And VO is that common now? We don't have to explain.
Well, that's voiceover.
Voiceover. Okay, good.
Well, I would assume most people know what VO is. But SOT was just something new that has recently come about in our conversation. So I thought we should just pick it up.
There you go.
Okay, so maybe a little bit of cheating, maybe not so much. But since you've already seen it, what's your three-word review?
So my three-word review, what is my three-word review?
Man, every week, three-word review. And Ted forgets one of them. There's a new hashtag, Ted Forgot.
Ted Forgot. So my three-word review for Lost in Space, because, you know, I think they're really going for the biggest audience they've ever gone for, is Danger, Bob Iger.
Danger, Bob Iger.
And you can take that two ways, because I think the superficial way is like, watch out, Disney, because now Netflix is really, really coming hard at like this core huge audience, the four quadrant thing, which is like a Disney special.
That there is the way I thought of it.
There's a second way. That is the way it was initially intended. But after watching all the episodes, when the robot in this version of Lost in Space says, "Danger, Will Robinson."
Danger, Will Robinson. Danger, no, Will Robinson. Danger.
I think there's actually a different meaning in this, because Danger, Will Robinson, when he says it throughout the season, it feels more like it's the one word that the robot knows, and it's a familiar kind of familial sharing. Like he heard somebody say danger, and it's just a way for him to draw Will Robinson into his circle.
Yeah.
I think there's, like I was talking about kindred spirits in for the Equalizer 2, I think there's a kindred nature between Reed Hastings and Bob Iger. I think there's a possible bromance if they could ever get together, kind of like a Mortimer, a Duke brother kind of trading places kind of thing they could get going.
Pay up, Mortimer. I've won the bet.
Here, $1.
Yeah, an interesting theme this week, too. So we have the robot in Lost in Space.
Uh-huh.
Westworld, obviously, is full of robots. And then Denzel is kind of the CIA killing robot who, I was going to say emotionless. And he's
a killing machine.
He's a killing machine, but he shows emotion when he needs to.
Right.
He shows the human side when he needs to, but otherwise he's like a robot killer for the CIA, you know, highly paid. So, yeah, interesting theme we have this week is Robot Killer.
Robot Killer Week on Trailer Junkies Podcast.
All right, Ted. So, hey, cool week. You know, I enjoyed the two. We haven't done TV in a little while.
Yeah, mix it up.
I thought it was pretty cool. You know, one thing we don't necessarily, we've done a number of Netflix movies, TV shows. We've done a little bit of HBO here and there. One thing we don't really ever do is like over the air, you know, ABC, NBC, CBS.
What's that? Is that linear television?
I don't know. You tell me.
Is that still going on?
I think so.
Oh, no, you're right. 18 million people can't be wrong, because that's what Roseanne had when she did her reboot. So it's still linear television is still there.
Anyway, I think we had another good week, and we'll see what comes up. And, you know, hey, have fun.
Cool week, Jimmy. Thanks again.
Yeah, looking forward to watching some of these. And really quick, do you think you're going to see any of them? Well, you already saw Lost in Space. You're probably going to watch Westworld.
So I saw Lost in Space. Westworld, I want to see. I'm going to be annoyed after watching an episode a night or two episodes on some nights that I'm going to have to wait every week for Westworld. That might grate on me. But I guess I have to catch up first, so I'll have some time to catch up.
There you go.
Season one. And then Equalizer 2, I want to see it, but I don't know that I will. I don't think I will. If I'm honest with myself, I probably won't see Equalizer 2.
And as I said in the past, you know, and I say week in, week out, it'll be an accidental viewing. I'll be on the sofa and I'll be like, oh, check that out. It just showed up in my stream. Well, how about we watch it tonight, you know? And then that's how we're going to see it. But like, it's a movie that I'm not going to go out of my way for.
Right.
I'm not going to make the effort to leave the house, to spend the money, to go watch it and get the bucket of popcorn. In other words, I'm going to hit the Roku and hit Netflix and go like, oh, Equalizer 2. Let's go make popcorn. It's Friday night or whatever, Saturday night. And then like you just happen upon it. So you're just going to happen to watch it. And then you're going to go to bed and go like, meh, glad I didn't spend too much for it. Anyway, man, I'll catch you next week. How about?
All right. Have a good night.
All right. You too.
See ya.
Next week, join Jim and Ted as they disarm another Hollywood bomb or marketing masterpiece. Remember, the holy trinity of podcasting. Subscribe, like, share.
Special thanks to Jeremy Kent Jackson for the voiceover and Rahelio for the music.